morning. Thank you for inviting me to talk to you. And thank you for your interest. I'm delighted that everything has been rearranged because it actually works very well. Because we've had an overview and now we're going to focus in to the Laborschule, the laboratory school. And that means that we can look specifically at a particular instance and look in differentiated detail at a radical school experiment and what actually constitutes that. So I'll briefly talk about the Laborschule, the laboratory school, and then about the French gymnasium. And at the end, there's a brief animated film about the French grammar school. On the outskirts of Bielefeld, directly next to the huge university building complex, there's a dark red low-lying building with a sawtooth roof. It looks like a factory from the outside, but it's home to one of the most important experiments in German progressive education around the 1970s, the Laborschule and the Oberstufenkolleg Bielefeld. They're affiliated in organisational terms to the university, and new forms of teaching were, and still are, developed, applied, and given an academic reflection in both schools, all under the same roof. If you enter the building today, the interior is not impressive so much for its details, but rather for its split-level classroom. That has nothing to do with the configuration of conventional school buildings. In terms of construction, the building resembles a factory building. It's composed of simple concrete elements and is illuminated by sawtooth roofs. The functional centre of each of the two schools is made up of three large teaching areas, which can be used as a basis of the situation. I actually wanted a laser pointer to point things out to you, because here... Anyway, it doesn't matter. Here you can see one of these teaching fields. And each of these three fields is 311 square metres in the Laborschule, and in the Oberstufenkolleg they're 414 square metres. The teaching fields are framed and accessed by narrow two-storey edge strips. That's the term used for this bit here. The lower level serves as circulation, the upper level is for quiet work. That's why I wanted the laser pointer, but don't worry, I'll manage anyway. But unfortunately, off mic. So you have no interpretation now. Perhaps someone can tell the speaker that he can only be interpreted if he speaks into a microphone. So as I was saying, you've got the upper level for quiet work and the lower level. The lower level of this edge strip is 1.5 metres lower, the upper level is 1.5 metres higher than the level of the actual fields. Four short stairs, one of which can be seen at the back of this image, are set in the corners of the fields. And they serve as a connection to the margins. To this day, teaching continues in the open plan part of the two schools, although the usage practice and the didactics have of course changed again and again since the schools were opened 45 years ago. The Bielefeld school projects are the only schools in Germany where regular teaching is still taking place successfully in open plan area. Here you can see a section, it's a conceptual section by Ludwig Leon. You can see the fields with these edge strips. The schools were initiated, conceived and led by renowned progressive educationist Hartmut von Hentig. He managed to combine his appointment as Professor of Educational Science at the newly founded University of Bielefeld in 1968 with founding and development of the two schools, and he was principal there until 1987. The Laborschule and the Oberstufenkolleg share the same building. Its structure is based on design by Berlin architect Ludwig Leo. He developed what was called the preliminary design in 1971, but he later left the project after arguments. The building opened in 1974 and was built by West Berlin's Planungskollektiv No. 1, a politically oriented architectural office that was established in the context of student politicization at TU Berlin in summer 1968. Planungskollektiv No. 1 became famous inter alia for building a restaurant based on the Miro prefab building system at the Plentowald Cultural Park, which is in East Berlin. The Oberstufenkolleg has 800 pupils, focuses on the transition from school to university, and is oriented towards the system of US American colleges. The Laborschule is an integrated comprehensive school for grades 0 to 10 with 600 pupils. The school's ambitious educational programme and their buildings are on the one hand products of their time, but on the other hand, they're an outstanding exception to that. Most school reforms in the 60s and 70s aimed at more efficient education, to improve economic performance, and also to foster equal opportunities for pupils from all social classes, as we just heard. However, the school experiments in Bielefeld focused on continuously reflected research and practical testing of radically new forms of teaching, which places the individual pupil and his or her individual personality right at the centre of the work. On the right-hand side, you can see a sign saying, please don't smoke here. No smoking, the critical thrust, institutional self-reflection. And there we go, now I've got a pointer, great. So where was I? Yes, the critical thrust, institutional self-reflection of socio-political objectives of the two schools were formulated by founder Hartmut von Hentig in his book entitled Systemzwang und Selbstbestimmung, which roughly means systemic coercion and self-determination. It was published in 68 and it demanded that school pupils learn techniques of change and thinking in alternatives. One of his tenets was the idea of the de-schooled school, which he developed by engaging with works by Austrian-American philosopher and theologian Ivan Illich. De-schooled school meant that mere instruction should be rolled back so that the school become more permeable to extracurricular life, without, of course, in the process denying the fundamental character of the school as an institution of transition. As modern society is complex and abstract, it's all the more important that schools learn to deal with the systemic character of the world. Of course, if that's to work properly, the school must become an experiential space. Experiential space is a very important term. It means, and I quote, the pupil should not only learn from the school, in other words, from its made and makeable orders, its social forms and hierarchies, external and internal relations, conflicts and annoyances, buildings and environment, but should also act and experience these. End of quote. American psychologist Ronald Lippitt, who focused on the school as an institution and the experience of the pupils in the school, took a similar approach. He made these topics the subject matter of his teaching. Von Hentig had met Lippitt on a study trip through the USA in 67. He was enthusiastic about how Lippitt tried to teach the students a set of instruments that would enable them to research, and I quote, and even expose the institution's habits and prevailing laws, end of quote. Von Hentig undertook the study trip with Gerald Umo Becker, later principal of the Odenwaldschule, who a few years ago became notorious as a pedophile sexual offender. On their journey, the two also visited the laboratory school at the University of Chicago that was founded in 1896 by the progressive educationist John Dewey, and that was the school that gave its name to the Laborschule, the laboratory school in Bielefeld. In his article, School as Experience, published in Bauwelt in 73, to frame a report on the first plans for these two schools, von Hentig also addressed architectural issues. The text concludes with a plea for advocating completely new school architecture that would make it possible to gain experience. Von Hentig calls for, and I quote, a lot of rough ground, a little shelter from the weather and agitated maintainers of good order. Sheds, sheds and more sheds, materials and functions that are visible and accessible. Spaces that are not idyllic and not a station hall, some of which offer openness and the other security and cosiness, but both do not teach or instruct why they're actually needed and when to give them up. It's about hybrid forms, about incompleteness, a certain degree of dirtiness. Here, humanity can assert itself against the system, end of quote. Von Hentig's systems must be understood against the backdrop of the highly technical, rationalised school buildings that from the late 60s onwards were built in Germany and were underpinned by a planning style imbued with optimistic faith in the future. The paradigm shift towards a new self-proclaimed progressive approach to planning of school building in West Germany was marked by the architectural competition for the full-day grammar school in Osterborken in 67. It was a groundbreaking competition. The task of building a school and its pedagogical programme were viewed as an abstract process-oriented organisational challenges. Long tables, complex diagrams, strictly functional layouts, and a programmatic marginalisation of outside views testify to the planners rationalising design methods. The corresponding architectural drawings look like depersonalised, utilitarian circuit diagrams of future-oriented learning and socialisation machines. This paradigm shift went hand-in-hand with a commitment, architecturally and pedagogically, to clusters and to open-plan classrooms. Open plan was understood then as an open and structured space, but also one that had a flexibly modifiable spatial continuum. The aim was to place the traditional system of classroom cells and corridors with room continuums, with areas that were open and closed and changeable to varying degrees, to form differentiated room constellations for different learning situations and group sizes. These ideas very quickly dominated debates. The authors of a school building documentation could state as early as 1969, I quote, "Ideally, the new school is a whole with as broad a span as possible, flexibly extendable, fully air-conditioned, with sawtooth roofs as an opening for daylight," end of quote. Decisive influences in this respect came from Great Britain and the USA. As this example here shows, schools with open and variable spatial configuration based on prefabricated systems have been built there since the mid-50s. The planning and implementation of the Laborschule and the Oberstufenkolleg occur against this backdrop. Rationalisation, open plan, technical equipment, flexible usability were central aspects, but were also sharply criticised in their contemporary form by the decisive stakeholders in the planning process. As a means of programming the right kind of person for hygienic, harmonious, high-performance society, as Hentig put it in polemical terms in 1973. A completely new type of school would emerge in Bielefeld in the critical engagement with the contemporary school building paradigms. The road to arriving at the final building that was actually built and realised was complicated and confused, but it began with the concept of Berlin architect Ludwig Leo, who understood how to translate progressive educationist ideas into convincing images of a radically different kind of school. Leo had three partners, just as supported Rudi Hull and Thomas Krebs. They'd supported him in other projects as employees and drew up a so-called preliminary draft for the laboratory school, but later withdrew from the project after a dispute. On the basis of their preliminary draft, Berlin colleagues from Planungskollektiv No. 1, who'd initially developed a separate building for the Oberstufenkolleg, realised a joint house, a joint building, shared for economic reasons by the two distinct schools, the Laborschule and the Oberstufenkolleg. Planungskollektiv No. 1 had to rein in their ambitions in various respects in implementing the design. That means that Leo's preliminary design soon became a surface upon which to project imaginations of a lost ideal, certainly as far as many people recalled it, and that was a design that was seen as being crushed between administrative interests and economic logic. Leo and his team worked out this preliminary design directly on site in Bielefeld in the first half of 71, after having inspired progressive educationists with their ideas at a competitive workshop in January and having been selected as architects for the Laborschule. The plans are hard to read and require a professional eye, but the presentation at the workshop was aimed at non-architects. He therefore worked with about 45 coloured slides, dividing his ideas into, and I quote, "a series of particularly fascinating building concept elements." As one of his listeners recalled, "Even some of the 45 slides remain cryptic without explanatory texts, but if you look at them all together, they give a good impression of how Leo conceived the open plan classroom, spatially and technically. In their visual translation of the design concept, these first images are more instructive than the plans that were drawn up when it comes to grasping Leo's architectural response to Van Hentig's call for a de-schooled school." So there's three slides here, the contrast's not great. There are three images set one next to the other, but it's perhaps rather difficult to see that on the slide. The starting point of Leo's presentation at the workshop was the organizational configuration and layout principle of the Laborschule. Although he also repeatedly made reference to the Oberstufen Kolleg, for example, on the right you can see the initial plan with the Laborschule and the Oberstufen Kolleg, shown as two distinct buildings and the road in between and the connecting element. But then that was all put together and combined. That was an administrative decision that had to be all in one building. Leo developed the building over a square grid, the split level organisation into fields and edge strips, which still characterise the interior of the schools to this day, had already been worked out at this very early design phase. It's calculated there and drawn on the image. There's a bright red coloured plan for an underground road network for forklift troughs that you can see here as well. That was to serve as a means of transport for the school's internal logistics. The forklift truck must be understood as a solution for supplying teaching materials to users, but it also stands metaphorically for the paradigm of learning in open-plan classrooms that's as flexible as possible, and the idea of an architecture that's primarily a protective shell and infrastructure for the educational programme. Here's three further slides showing this project. One focus of this presentation was the technical challenges of the open-plan space. Natural lighting and ventilation are problematic, as are noise levels. Leo wanted to do without air conditioning and artificial lighting and designed a roof that would allow the open plan space to be lit and ventilated naturally, at least to a large extent. In his meticulous technical planning, Leo's architecture is a shell serving the space inside, developed from the sense of obligation vis-a-vis the demands of classical architectural modernism to promote light, air and openness. Leo's ideas about using adobe in the interior also point to natural air conditioning techniques to support natural regulation of heat and humidity. Here you can see studies on the lighting and the ventilation, the input of fresh air. There you can see the heating, and over there you can see the material elements that are used to control the acoustic setup, for example, with curtains and such like here. The slides are not terribly clear, I'm not quite sure why that is. The schematic floor plans and technical details sections should not be considered on their own. The focus on technical questions really makes sense if you look at this together with pictures of the school in use. Leo articulated this in the form of several narrative sections. They have an almost naive style, but they aim to be particularly easily legible. These sections show the experiential space of the D-School school through the prism of various situations. He produced various versions of these sections, including three large format sheets that you can join together to make a drawing that's almost 4 metres long. In the drawings, he shows large and small groups, concentrated learning and studying and reading, joined experimentation and discussion, protected and open spaces, fold-out rostrums and stairs, quiet rooms, corners, niches, a cinema, a stage, a library, workshops, laboratories, and open spaces of the fields of instruction. The space of this school is conceived to be infinitely extendable, just as the architectural space does not set any limits to the forms of teaching. The section drawings show Leo's interest in temporary group formations of collaborative work and learning, depicting them again and again, very consciously, as dense constellations of figures. True to scale insertion of people into the space and their interaction with architecture and furniture become tangible as independent themes in Leo's architecture, his depiction techniques and the approaches of progressive education, and they're brought together to form a common narrative. Here you can see the forklift truck somewhere or other. There it is. Leo's work concentrates solely on the interior, and that corresponds to the paradigms of school building at the time. The aim was not to create a prestigious external effect that symbolised pedagogical content, but rather to create a programme of spaces and functions for optimised learning processes spread across the floor space. Leo's internal division of space is a response to this. He divided the open plan area into split levels, designing it as a graduated continuum with a range of visual relationships. The radical implementation of the open plan idea, the opening up to daylight and robust installations were decisive aspects in combining pedagogy and architecture. One important difference between this and most open plan schools is Leo's rejection of flexible wall systems, much discussed at the time as to whether they were really viable in everyday teaching setups. That's all the more striking because in many of his other projects, Leo used sliding doors and gates and so on to enable different room configurations, but that's not the case here. Leo's design for the Laborschule sees its role as a critical examination of the contemporary practice of high-tech school buildings. He didn't question the architectural conditions and pedagogical promises of the open-plan school, but tried to recalibrate the unstable field of tension between pedagogy and humans, architecture and technology, through his architectural mode of thought. Technology was not only something fascinating, but a vehicle for social emancipation. On the one hand, he planned his projects and their technical installations meticulously, sometimes rigidly, but he also listened very carefully to his future users. Both aspects are inextricably linked. In his design for the Laborschule, the ideal typical way in which he transformed the technical dimension into dialectic images becomes visible. On the one hand, you see the forklifts and the open plan spaces, products of rational calculations under industrial production. Yet on the other hand, they also become instruments and metaphors of emancipation. The images of technology are contradictory, referring both to a functionalist system and to the way in which this can be overcome in play. The factory hall and technical installations become a place of liberation from systemic constraints, for they are less functionally determined, the conventional classroom. It makes sense to look back 5 years to understand better how Leo actually reconceived school architecture. In 1966, he attracted a great deal of attention from architects and educationists in his design for the new French grammar school in Berlin. In this competition, the setting was very different from that in Bielefeld. There was to be a new contemporary school building for a renowned bilingual school founded in the 17th century. It was to move to an inner city area just north of planned city motorway. That motorway was never built, but the unfavourable location was a central challenge in the competition. And that was one of the very few open competitions for architectural projects at the level of the Berlin city government in the post-war years, but Leo's project was not taken on board. It was won, this competition, by Hans-Joachim Piesal and Eike Rollenhagen, who implemented the fairly conventional project between 67 and 74. Both architects are very present in current architectural debates. Piesal, who's recently died, co-created the Diesterweg Gymnasium in Wettingen, Berlin. There's heated debate about its future use. Eike Rollhagen is engaged in activism in Munich to preserve the Gasteig Cultural Centre. He realised that in the early 80s, and it's seen in Munich as an unpopular piece of brick brutalism, which is likely to be greatly revamped in the future. The competition for the French grammar school exemplifies conflicts between politically supported reform efforts, radical progressive educational demands, and architectural logics in the mid-60s. It triggered a wide-ranging debate within the Berlin architectural community. Many had hoped a building would be built that would lead the way in education and correspond to the latest findings in school construction. The Berlin journal Bauwelt focused on the result of the competition. It was critical of the spatial programme drawn up by the administration and by most of the designs, which were full of compromise and uncertainties. The decisive step, namely open plan approaches and flexible room configurations, were only taken on board half-heartedly, Bauwelt said. That's why the new building didn't offer the necessary spatial framework for contemporary forms of teaching. And this critique can be seen in the special issue of the student magazine of the French grammar school Notre Parole. Their art teacher, Rudy Muller, helped the pupils to look at the decision-making processes of the competition. They formulated precise critique of the award-winning prize, demanded user participation, and presented 4 designs from the competition that they considered successful. Leo's design was presented as the best entry in the entire competition, which is not surprising, because Leo exchanged ideas intensively with Muller prior to his design work. These discussions led to the idea of an elaborate solution with a multifunctional hall for the artistic centre of the school, and indeed, viewed this hall as the actual core of the design. This multi-purpose changeable hall is an ideal example of how Leo worked with movable elements to enable different room configurations and different uses, which in turn were intended to strengthen formation of the school community. So we're now going to see a film about this. Antje Buchholz and her colleague produced this in Berlin with me and another colleague. And it's for an exhibition on the Umlauf tank, this is in cooperation with the archive of Ludwig Leo in the Academy of the Arts. We're going to see 5 minutes of this now. It's divided up into chapters, and we'll see the part on the French grammar school now. And here comes the film.
In the summer of 1966, Leo took part in an open competition for a new building for the venerable French grammar school in the Tiergarten district of Berlin. The site for the school building was immediately north of a planned urban highway. Lighting and noise protection were therefore the central challenges in the competition. At the centre of Leo's design was a flexible, multifunctional hall, intended to promote the development of a sense of community in the bilingual school. There were gates and flaps connecting the multifunctional hall with the adjacent rooms. Leo used movable arrays of telescopic seating stands, making different types of usage possible. Hall seating. Interconnected arrays of telescopic rows of benches, with a total of 6 storage blocks, each with seating for 108 people in 12 rows. Arranging even the most complicated configurations for spectators and activities only takes as much time as a mid-morning break between classes. This makes storage for chairs unnecessary and frees up valuable floor space.
The hegemony of administrators may one day require the following definition. Quality means whatever nobody has any objection to.
The jury did not select Leo's design. In the public debate that followed the competition, several architects and teachers described his project as representing a missed opportunity. They expressed particular appreciation for the variable and flexibly usable rooms. Leo went on to develop similarly adaptable spaces again and again.